and welcome to Women for Elections in Conversation podcast series. In this episode, journalist Alison O'Connor is in conversation with Claire Daly MEP. Claire joins Alison for a discussion on the importance of activism and her political journey from her car while travelling to Bulgaria to attend a demonstration. She discusses the issues currently facing the people of Bulgaria and her role as an MEP in this.
So on to today, and we're absolutely thrilled to have Alison and Claire with us today. Alison O'Connor is one of our foremost journalists, authors and broadcasters in Ireland, and she's a real friend of Women for Election and has supported us through many events over the last number of years, and we're really grateful to have her here today. Thank you, Alison, for joining us. We'd particularly like to welcome Claire, Claire Daly. Claire will be familiar to many of you across the country, both for her local and national and now European elected positions. I suppose if we were to take a case study of a woman who has been through the entire gamut of political representation in Ireland, right through from trade union activism, students' union, council, Dáil, and now into the European Parliament as an MEP. So Claire has been through the entire gamut, and we think she'll have a fascinating story to tell us on that journey, and hopefully a few words of wisdom for women that are considering treading the same path. So thank you, Claire, for joining us, and hi to Alison and Claire. I'll hand over to you now.
Alison, thank you very much. And I know also that you, as well as being a hugely successful businesswoman, are a driving force behind Women for Election. So this is an unusual interview insofar as I'm sitting here in the safety of my home office. But Claire Daly is somewhere in Bulgaria. I don't know where. And Claire doesn't know where either. So Claire, you might tell us where you left and where you're going to and why you're there, just to begin with.
Well, good question, because you're totally right. I haven't a clue where I am, except it's somewhere on the road between Sofia, the capital, which I was never in before, and Burgas, which is on the way to a seaside resort in Bulgaria. And I'm here, I suppose, for two reasons. I mean, firstly, when I got elected to the European Parliament, a number of Irish property owners who had bought sort of summer apartments in the seaside part of Bulgaria and were being really ripped off by the property developer. They'd had a problem going back over 10 years. They'd been in touch with other MEPs and so on. So when the changeover came, they got in touch with me, and I had the opportunity to raise their case in the parliament about a year ago. And actually through that then, some Bulgarians, because unlike Ireland, what happens in the European Parliament is actually covered in Bulgaria. So other Bulgarians then started to get in touch about corruption and other issues that were going on in Bulgarian society. And a year on, actually they're tomorrow, they're in their 100th day of protests demanding that the government stand down over corruption. It's been totally incredible. We've got a really hard-hitting motion passed in the parliament, and they asked me to address and be a guest speaker at their 100th day of protests in Sofia tomorrow night. Now, I have a meeting in the seaside area to try and resolve the apartment issue. But we're coming back to Sofia to meet activists. And it's kind of incredible, because there's been a load of people in contact saying, oh, my God, I hear you're in Bulgaria. You're in Bulgaria. Can I meet you about my case with corruption, or my case about this or that? But yeah, so that's where we're here. I'm here primarily for a meeting with the property owners, but also making use of that time to link up with civil society organizations. Tomorrow I'm meeting some people who have been the victims of homophobic attacks recently in Bulgaria as well. And I suppose it's part of my brief as a member of the Libe Committee and the projects for rule of law and democracy that the European Union talks about but doesn't always deliver on. But where I am, I couldn't tell you.
Well, it's even fascinating to hear about you travelling in such a wide-ranging manner that you're in neither Brussels or Strasbourg. In fact, the Parliament, I think, hasn't even been going to Strasbourg of late. At a time, particularly around here, everything has been really tied down in terms of restrictions. So I suppose I'm wondering what it's like there in terms of the virus and even your freedom to roam, or how that has been affected.
Yeah, I mean, and that is really interesting. And I'm really conscious looking at the media from afar here. And since the lockdown started in February, I've only been home twice. both those time pretty much isolated. I made it to my mother's garden. She didn't even allow me in the house, but I wasn't really anywhere else the two times that I was at home. But I'm really conscious of all the lockdown, all of the regulations that seem to change all the time, you know. But for us, I wouldn't say life is going on as normal, because that's not true. Actually, in Belgium is probably the worst country in Europe. In Brussels last week, there were
virus levels.
Absolutely. Like one day last week in Brussels, the rate of cases was 10,000 cases in Brussels, not to mind the whole of Belgium. It was astronomical. It's probably the worst city in Europe. And yet up until last Thursday, the pubs were open outside. We had to go around outside. We wear our masks. We wear our masks in shops. There's social distancing. But life is going on pretty much as normal with masks and all of that stuff. But like the pubs have been shut since last Thursday. But like the unlimited coverage, the relentless news featuring of the issues doesn't happen here. And I mean, like travel is synchronized across mainland Europe. Like Bulgaria, the rates are pretty low. So I didn't need a test. I didn't need anything to come to Bulgaria. I won't need to quarantine when I go back. But like
on the ground there, Claire, how obvious is it?
Oh, in Bulgaria, it's not obvious really at all. I mean, we were going around wearing our masks and it was kind of like we were the freaks, like people, we were kind of forgetting, like, you know, that people here aren't wearing them. In shops, they do pretty much, but not really. Definitely not out on the streets. On public transport, yes, but that's it. And like the people were telling us, there's been really no restrictions at all in Bulgaria. But like everywhere else, the cases in Bulgaria are rising, but they're not particularly perturbed about it. And the same, we were in Italy last week and they just changed overnight because Brussels and Belgium are so bad. They introduced a system of testing in the airports. And this is what I don't understand about Ireland being an island nation. And obviously I come from, you know, an aviation constituency and I've had so many pilots and cabin crew in touch. Aviation, it's on its knees. People can leave Ireland through the north of Ireland and yet the government are don't even have a testing centre in the airport. I can't get my head around that because it's just the norm now in Europe. You travel and the MEPs travel, you test. I've had loads of tests. The test results come back within 24 hours. You know, you keep it low, you wear your mask and then you go on pretty much. And then we look at what's going on in Ireland and we go, oh my God, the country is, it's on its knees. And I can't get my head around it. And I'm conscious of the sacrifices, but...
Claire, what, I mean, if I could just bring you back, you were a really strong presence, and as far as I was concerned, a really positive, disruptive, and I say that in the best possible way, presence in Leinster House for a number of years. And what decided you that, you know, had you had enough of domestic politics? What was it about Europe that that drew you?
Well, I suppose it's a couple of things, right? And it is a bit of a weird one. And it was strange that somebody would go to Europe when, and this might sound arrogant and don't mean it to be, but kind of when you're at the top of your game, like, yeah, you know, when there was no reason, I could have stood for election. You know, I was very active and, you know, vocal, whereas normally Europe was treated as sort of a retirement home for people or a place for people who wanted to establish themselves in domestic politics. But I suppose through being a member of the Justice Committee, which... a bit like here in the Liebe Committee, 50% of the legislation in Ireland comes through the Justice Committee. And we were seeing more and more of that emanating in Europe. And yet Europe never really features in Ireland, but it dictates so much of the way our lives are. I just suppose we were a bit curious on the one hand to see, could you make a difference? Is it that big monolithic bureaucratic nightmare that is irreformable? Or is it something that you could have an impact on? And I mean, we're a year and a little bit in and I still can't answer that question. But I think we wanted to try and see.
Well, what's
could
your,
you shake it up
you
a bit?
You can't answer it yet. What's your sense of that?
Well, the one thing that I've registered, and it's something that we'd said, but COVID kind of interrupted it. There's a huge disconnect between the way in which Europe is covered in the Irish media and the way it's covered in the rest of Europe. Like, I mean, this sounds mad, and it is mad. It's mad to me even, but I am nearly a household name in Bulgaria. I mean, it's just absolutely unbelievable. I am viral on Facebook. They don't really use Twitter because of interventions I made in the parliament. Now, there's not a single person in Ireland who probably heard a single intervention that I've made in the parliament since I went there, but yet people in Bulgaria have heard the intervention.
Why is that, do you think?
I think because they invest in it, like they have their media located there, they follow the events. And it's something that I had raised with the Irish MEPs that we need to get the Irish government to do. And I don't mean just having media to tag what the Irish MEPs are doing, but having media to cover what's going on in the European Parliament, in the European Council, in the European Commission, because nobody knows. I didn't know. I didn't even really know that the European Parliament goes to Strasbourg once a month. What a big and utter waste of European taxpayers' money and destruction of the environment. Nobody even talks about that. Obviously, COVID has cut across that.
If you're somebody who's instantly recognisable in Bulgaria and it's the issue of corruption, what can you do about it?
Well, Bulgaria and Romania were in what they call this cooperation and verification mechanism. So it was kind of like a sort of a tiered approach that they had to kind of improve a couple of things about judicial independence and all the rest before they'd kind of get full membership. So they were in this sort of waiting purgatory sort of zone. And last year, the parliament were ready to release them. And actually, me and our group, we're the smallest group in the parliament. We were the only ones who objected. But a year on, and now we've had really hard-hitting motions passed because the people of Bulgaria have begun to protest. I mean, I suppose what they're saying is, I mean, there's massive systemic corruption whereby billions of European funds are literally going out of the European Union into the pockets of an oligarchic mafia. And like the scandals have been well established, like they're not up to, you know, I couldn't be sued for saying this because there's no dispute about the facts. Like there's evidence of the prime minister colluding with the former prosecutor to, you know, corrupt judges and all this. So, and the people know this.
Obviously the people there, unlike maybe what Irish people would think, believe that this being raised by MEPs, raised as an issue in the parliament, that something can happen. And I guess that's maybe the difference between what you'd have between an Irish voter and a Bulgarian voter.
I think what it is they see the money. The money is being used to give, empower and enable these corrupt people to carry on doing what they're doing. And it reminded me a bit of the movement against the, when the Dunn strikers took action for the apartheid that time about boycotting South African goods. It's the people in Bulgaria are saying, we don't want European money going to fund these oligarchs who are suppressing us and enriching themselves. And that's kind of it. And it's a little bit different because Ireland, of course, now is a net contributor to the European Union. We're not pocketing money, we're giving it, you know.
Can I bring you back? I mean, you've had a real political trajectory. It started with you, I'm presuming this is where it started, president of the Students' Union in DCU. What made you political? What was it about you or your background or, you know, where did that come from?
I've no idea. Like, and I did a thing for Bulgarian television this morning and your man had done his homework and he said, I can't believe this. He said, your father was a colonel in the army. He said, I read your brother is a priest and yet I see you and you have these tattoos. You seem to be liberal, you know? And I said, well, I got the tattoos for my 50th birthday. I said, I felt I was entitled to at that stage. So I paid for them myself. And I said, but I suppose my background was different, but it was a social justice background. And while I myself may have not be religious now, I respect the right of anybody else to have a religious belief and so on. So I suppose we were kind of reared with a sense of social justice. And while I come from an army family, I'm obviously intensely anti-militarist and support Ireland's neutrality. But I think that's kind of in keeping with a lot of Irish people's view that Ireland has been able to play a role far beyond our weight on the world stage by being peacekeepers, by talking to everybody, by not taking sides. And that's huge capital. It's meant we've been able to do things and been accepted by all sides, which maybe other people haven't been able to do, you know. But what made me, what makes anybody what they are? I really don't know. I kind of wandered into it. You're right, like it was Students' Union politics. It was probably, I joined the Labour Party around the 1986 divorce referendum, which was defeated at that time. And so social issues, it was the 1980s. A lot of our young people were leaving. People I went to college with had to emigrate to get work in England and all that kind of stuff. So the usual stuff. I suppose I just never grew out, but I just kept doing it, you know.
And then you went on then and you were, I think, well over a decade was a councillor with Fingal County Council and then elected to the Dáil in 2011. What? I mean, even it's a relatively short space of time since then. It's less than a decade. But what was it like to be a woman in the Dáil then? And even whether you think things have progressed, I know in percentage terms, things are still not great, but whether it's evolved any bit, whether it's more easier or more acceptable for women to be in the National Parliament.
I think it is. I really think it is. Like, and I'm kind of on record as saying, like, when the idea of quotas and that came out, I was kind of against it. I felt that it had a sort of a patronising intent, or let people stand on their own two feet and be judged on merit. But actually seeing the quota system introduced for funding in relation to candidates, I think it has changed behaviour. And there's no doubt the more women being present are serving as role models across the spectrum. So I do think it's, you know, easier now. It's probably not a phrase I would use, but I mean, people always ask me, like, it actually did take me a good while to get to the Dáil now. I stood in a lot of elections. I lost as many as I won to get there and came close. Like, you know, there was a 10-year gap in coming close a couple of times before I actually ended up in the Dáil. So it wasn't easy. It was like, you know, more than 10 years of fighting elections all the time, you know. And people said when you got elected, well, what was it like? Was it like what you thought? And I said, well, do you know what? I never actually thought what it would be like. It took so long to bloody well get there. You're just trying to get there all the time that you never thought what it would be like. But I mean, it is daunting to go from somebody who just is somebody, which you still are, to the media talking about you and stuff, which is very invasive and is problematic. And I think they do it in a particular way with women as well, which is more insidious, you know. So you're more under scrutiny.
I was looking at your Twitter feed earlier and I noticed that it was interesting, given that I suppose there's often it's a love hate, but there's a close enough relationship between journalists and politicians. But I noticed that you've over 36,000 followers and you only follow 30 people yourself, which is quite an interesting ratio. And that out of those, you only follow two journalists, and that's Vincent Brown and Jean Kerrigan. So it's just curious, is that indicative of anything?
That's terrible. Mick Clifford's going to go mad. My absolute favourite. No, I mean, look, I'm not great on Twitter. I actually amn't. I'm not as good on Twitter as I should. I get some information from Twitter myself, generally on international media, and that I don't like the tidbits and the gossip and that. So I don't really, I kind of use it as a bit of a platform, but not really. Do you know what I mean? So it's not that, oh, I think I'm great and I couldn't be bothered following other people. I suppose I just don't really use it, but I don't tend to get a huge amount of information from it.
Do you think you were, I interrupted you earlier, do you think that women politicians in Ireland get a harder time from the media or indeed from social media?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably fair to say. I mean, it's not nice, the scrutiny. Nobody likes being in the public eye. And I mean, I even noticed the times of standing for election, I think as a woman, people, and you put your poster up and your poster is going to be, you know, commented upon because of your physical appearance or whatever. So you'd have comments right about how you dress, how you look, what size you are, that kind of thing, which nobody obviously likes. But I think it's definitely, that is much more apparent against women. You wouldn't hear that spoken about as much, not at all. And that's pretty insidious. And I think that is still there, you know, commentary about how women look and dress and behave is much more invasive than for men, for sure. And that is led in part by the media, also social media, I think, can be very destructive anyway against everybody. And it's a little bit of a mad space. That's kind of why I don't really go there that much. I kind of use it to get a message out, but I never interact on social media because I think it's kind of dangerous territory where people say things that they wouldn't say normally, you know. But yeah, no, I think you're right. I think women do get a harder time.
A lot of people will say how much that affects their mental health. Do you find that's an issue if you do immerse yourself in it and read what people can write?
Oh, I wouldn't dream of reading a single thing that anybody said about me. If I did, I wouldn't get out of bed in the morning. So I deliberately don't follow negative comments. I don't, like, sometimes you can't avoid it, but generally I don't engage in that at all. Like, I mean, you know, it would be said that, like, if you accept a negative comment, like, you're kind of, you're just ratifying that opinion. So you're better off ignoring it. Yeah. It only becomes a negative comment if you take it on board. So I just ignore it and I don't interact.
We were talking about getting elected and you were talking about the amount of times over a decade that you went for it. Then we were talking there about how it can be difficult and the comments made and all of that. So the problem is, and I find this when you talk to female politicians who have made it, but who can talk, there can be a lot of negatives. So, I mean, if I was considering standing and I'm looking at you and you're a politician I admire and you think, OK, well, I might have to keep going for 10 years before I make it to Leinster House.
Yes.
And I have all that crap to put up with from be it the media or social media. So, you know, what's the draw?
Yeah, I mean, look, I never held that necessarily as a negative because I never was obsessed on the idea of getting to the end goal. In some ways, the campaigning and trying to get there was part of the fight. So along the road to getting elected, there were a huge number of battles. There were a huge number of battles in the students' union movement for abortion information and so on. And I was really lucky then, all those years later, whether it was lucky or tragic, that it was still that long ahead when I got into the Dáil, that we were still fighting that fight, but I was able to use that position to play a bit of a role in that as well. Trade union struggles, community struggles, all of those in and of themselves. It wasn't just about using them to get elected, but they were all worthy in their own right. And it was through that. I mean, I suppose I view electoral politics as a vehicle to organize from. So the organizing and the campaigning goes on regardless, but I've just been privileged to be somebody who happened to get elected. So I'm going to do what I do anyway, but I suppose I'm lucky that I have the platform then so my view can be maybe less ignored and I can use that to advance various interests then. I get a kick out of all of that.
If a woman approaches you and says they're interested in a political career, do you have set advice that you give, or do you tell them to run a million miles? Or
yeah, I do. And what I say is that they shouldn't view it as a career, because if you focus on that as say, oh, I have to get elected, and that the end goal is the election, well, then you miss all of the very valuable experiences along the way to that. So what I say is that, you know, politics should be about changing the world or your community or your country or your continent or whatever for the common good. That's what it is for me. So it's working in collaboration with other people. So if you do that anyway, and yes, absolutely, as part of that, put yourself forward. Because, I mean, it was out of, I suppose, the community campaigns originally against the water charges in the 1990s, where we were campaigning against decisions being made at council and government level, that you kind of said, well, hang on a minute, we're spending all this energy now campaigning against those who are in power. It's about time we put ourselves forward and try to make the decisions. So I think I would encourage people to, why do they want to be involved? What are the things they want to change by being involved in politics? And then agitate on those issues anyway, and put yourself forward to see electoral politics. What have you got to lose in that? Like, it can only be beneficial for the struggle you're interested in anyway. So it's not about self-advancement or self-promotion, even though you're going to benefit personally by your life's experiences by doing that. But if you're, you know, engaged in that struggle, well, then, you know, it's worth it anyway. And then if you get elected in the end, great, you know, and, you know,
there's a questions are coming up. There's a comment here though from Maureen McGovern who says, we miss you, Claire, please come back. I have a sense that won't be happening for a while, Claire, listening to you.
Well, I mean, my mother is just saying, she doesn't even know if she'd see me for Christmas, the way this COVID stuff is going on, if we even get back to Ireland at all, because we had great plans to use a lot of the resources here to organise events in Ireland, to highlight some of the stuff that is going on over there, which has had to go a little bit pear-shaped. And we do obviously have to look at facilities like webinar meetings and so on.
Briefly tell me what sort of things you want. This is yourself.
Well, we had organised a whole thing with sort of, so I suppose one of my things, my background was kind of aviation. So we had a lot of projects organised in terms of the in terms of pilots and cabin crew and aviation workers, right? sites, but also the environmental impact on that. And we also had a huge project in terms of Irish neutrality and the amount of European money now for the first time that's been spent on defence. So we hear a lot of talk now post-COVID about, you know, the cost of the recovery, who's going to pay for that recovery programme. And will we have to pay more? And one of the arguments we say is, well, why are we paying all this money for arms companies that are destabilising the world? And for the first time, the European budget is spending that. So all of those issues. So look, I don't know, would we come back? Maybe I will contest the next election. I really don't know. And I'm obviously very appreciative to people who say we need you there. And we do hear that. And I suppose I feel bad by that there isn't as much coverage about the work that is done in Europe, because I mean, myself and Mick Wallace have launched a podcast that we do to try and promote the issues that we raise. It has, you know, we're building a bit of a thing, but
Claire, I'm not sure whether it just skipped there. I heard podcast. Would you just start that sentence again?
Because I think sorry. It's point. No, I was saying, like, one, I feel bad, like, for Maureen and other people who say we miss you, and like, And we do get that, like, you know, but I feel bad that our work in the European Parliament doesn't get the prominence at home that I feel it would deserve. So we ourselves have launched a podcast, I Foresee Trouble, as in it's a pun on independence for change. So I Foresee Trouble with Daly and Wallace. So it features what comes up in the European Parliament every week. And we kind of try and do that to promote the work that we do. Ironically, and it seems mad, before the lockdown, but out of 700 MEPs, myself and Mick Wallace were in the top three speakers in the European Parliament, excluding the chairs of the meetings. And yet, I don't think anything that either of us have done featured at all at home. I've had pieces in The Guardian over issues I've raised, as I say, stuff in Bulgaria, but nothing in Ireland. But it's not that we're not doing stuff. It's just there's a real divide between what goes on in Europe, which is ironic because particularly now post-Brexit, we need to connect with what's going on in Europe, and yet it's really not happening, you know.
What is it like being on the left, in a politician on the left in Europe, as opposed to a politician on the left in Ireland or in Leinster House? Whereas traditionally, that the left in Ireland, you know, just spend a lot of time squabbling, and could be a stronger force, except for that.
Well, the left in the European Parliament now aren't much better. I would say they're a lot worse in some ways. I mean, look, we're in a group. It's called the left in the European Parliament, the United Left. So you can take it straight away. They're not united at all. I can guarantee you that. It's a fairly mixed bag. What we've found is there's actually good and bad in every political grouping across the spectrum. The European Parliament is organised differently. To get legislative files, you have to join a political group. But none of them are ideal, and they're all a mixed bag. I mean, there's some people in the Greens who are really radical, there's some who are really conservative, there's some in the far right group who are actually okay, they're not really far right, and there's some in the groups that Fine Gael are in with that are much more far right. So they're a mixed bag. And there's people outside the groups that we work very well with. I would actually say I work with people in all of the political groups. They are a mixed bag, but no, they like a good row as well.
On a national basis, then, with your fellow Irish MEPs, do you find yourself at times working with them for national reasons in a way that you would never have dreamt of doing with TDs from those parties in the Dáil? But you're pulling on Jersey.
Yeah, I mean, there is an element. Now, in fairness, now I would have always, while politically would have disagreed with colleagues in the Dáil, would have always personally kind of got on fine with everybody, like, you know. But yeah, you do notice, like, that the Irish anyway, and not every delegation would like that, but the Irish MEPs get on pretty well. Yeah. You know, you could go for months, like, without seeing somebody. If they're not on your committee, you wouldn't necessarily, or if they're not in your political group, you wouldn't see them. But some of them haven't been because of COVID.
A question here from Maura Rua, Claire, saying, as a TD, you were a great advocate for animals, and Maura also misses you. Do you see any opportunity to advance animal welfare at EU level?
Oh, definitely. And there's a really, really active animal welfare group and so on. There, I have my mask in my bag, if I could find it, for end caged animals and stuff. So there are quite a few campaigns run. Now, they're generally run through the Environment Committee, which I'm not a member of, but I am. There is a kind of a friendship group that's more informal, an animal welfare and animal rights group, and they do really good work. Like, they could do more, but they have been pretty proactive on stuff. So groups like that, they're pretty good at sort of interest issues. And there's going to be a lot of important votes next week on the CAP payments, the agricultural payments, to try and link amendments into any payments being linked to good animal welfare practices and so on, you know.
There's also, there's a comment here from Matty Fox. He's saying, it's not really a question, but Clare has mirrored his own frustration. Ireland has a third world health service that government decisions over the years. I'm amazed we don't have testing at airports. I have concluded that our health service is so low on resources that as a result, everything suffers.
Well, that's the way it looks like to me. I mean, I can't get over it. I mean, in Brussels Airport, in Milan Airport, and Milan just changed overnight, and they went to testing and they promised to give the results in 48 hours. You got your results in 24 hours. And we're an island nation and they can't do it. With an open border up the north, that's always going to stay open. It's crazy. And I do think he's right. It's because of the weakness of our health service, you know, which is seriously scary.
Well, it certainly got a lot of money in the budget on Tuesday, but as to whether that can be used to turn things around or not remains to be seen. Now, we touched on earlier about your interest, which started in your student union days, on women's reproductive rights. And you were the first TD I know to introduce a private member's legislation on pro-choice legislation. And I remember it well. I certainly got a sense that after the 2016 election, when you had an increase in the number of female TDs and that, and you could sense it in the Dáil on various issues, but even particularly in relation to, this was pre our abortion referendum, that simply having more women within Leinster House gave things momentum, or it was easier as a woman. Like, for instance, you knew what it was like to be virtually on your own on that issue, standing up, but that there was more a sense of the collective and women backing each other on this. Would you agree with that, or was it your experience?
It definitely helped. I mean, look, there was a process underway before, I suppose, 2016, and there was a momentum growing. But there's no doubt, as far as I'm concerned, the presence of some very strong pro-choice advocates, both at the Cabinet and in Fine Gael, steadied a lot of their troops through that process of the Citizens Assembly, the Oireachtas Committee and so on. So the role of the likes of Kate O'Connell, Catherine Zappone, probably Frances Fitzgerald, people who, and it probably benefited Frances Fitzgerald to have some of those younger women there at parliamentary party meetings, sort of correcting maybe sort of more, you know, traditional views that might have been there previously. It definitely helped. It definitely kept that going, like, you know. So it wasn't the reason why things happened, but it certainly helped for sure, you know.
So were there, even prior to that, were there issues where your gender made you feel more conscious about standing up and talking about them, or that you were? I remember, I mean, I often quote this, Eamon Gilmore, the former Labour Taoiseach, saying that when he first went into Leinster House, it reminded him of his all-boys boarding school. You know, did you feel that, where it took an extra effort to try, that there were certain issues to talk about, or did it
bother? I didn't, right? And I always kind of feel a bit bad by saying that, but I actually didn't. And I suppose that I came from a background of trade union politics, of left-wing politics, which actually, ironically, has been pretty male-dominated, even, you know, in a lot of sectors, actually. So I was probably used to operating in that type of environment, so it didn't seem kind of strange to me. That wasn't a factor for me.
Well, that's kind
but
of...
I mean, I always feel bad saying that, because I know it is a factor for other people, you know, but it just wasn't, you know.
Well, that's sort of, it's intriguing, because so many women talk about, and even other women I've spoken to about political careers, that feeling of not being good enough, of, you know, not feeling that you're up to the job. And, you know, that even when you have made it as such, or you're seen to have made it, that there's still a female thing to have this internal doubt.
I think everybody has that, though. I mean, I noticed, like, people would say to me, oh, you're a great speaker or whatever, and people say, but I mean, I would always be nervous every time before I get up to speak, and people say, oh, well, you'd never know that. And I said, well, I know you'd never know it, but it doesn't mean that I'm not nervous every time I get up to speak. And maybe that's why, because you care or you feel worried about it. Now, once I get the first words out, I'm grand, like, you know, but you'd be always, the heart to be racing a bit beforehand. But that's not because I kind of doubt myself, or I don't think it's because I'm a woman. I think it's because I just want to do my best, and you want to represent the views, or if it's an issue that you care about, you want to use the privileged position you've been given to articulate an opinion to its maximum effect, and you don't want to miss that boat on that. So I think everybody feels that, if they're, you know, and people shouldn't feel inadequate about that. That's what makes people good. It's because you care, you feel a bit, oh, that you're not good enough, or that you're hoping that you're going to be your best. But that's a good thing. Like, it should be promoted, actually.
And I suppose in relation to what you're saying about speeches, and I suppose maybe that's a bit of necessary adrenaline. It's what giving you before your performance. Alison Kauser has a question here where she's saying that we need to attract, it's a sort of a link on from this, I guess, we need to attract women from all backgrounds into politics. What's your advice to young women looking to get involved?
Well, I suppose, I think there's been some really good examples, and definitely female role models have been, you know, really great. Like, I mean, I think the sort of Lynn Ruan going into the Shannon as a sort of a working class woman, and as a proudly working class woman, was an excellent role model, and so on. You know, Eileen Flynn now as a traveller woman, and a proud traveller woman. There's no doubt.
She's getting very good. You made a very good media coverage, and represents herself really well.
And it's great because and because they're young as well. So young women are kind of saying, these people can do this now. And they're doing it in a different way. And like, I know when Eileen, when she said, oh God, my accent or my clothes, should I change the way I am? Or should I? No, be yourself. And when people are being themselves and they're reflecting the different types of women in society, I think young people say, well, yeah, actually, I could maybe do that as well. I don't have to be. I mean, years ago, before I went into the Dáil, the women who were in there, it's not just numbers, I think. It's the types of women now who are being elected. There are a lot more younger women. Like, when I was standing for election, it was generally older women who got elected, people who are my age now, in other words, you know. But now it's not unusual for women in their 20s or 30s and young people, which is great, like, because that is what will make the difference, you know.
Yeah, I suppose you don't. The only thing is, you don't, you do, you see that. But I mean, when you consider all of the women are young people, and this isn't just women actually who might have been involved in the marriage equality referendum and subsequently the abortion referendum. It's the, you might have hoped that maybe there would have been more that would have been picked up, who would have gone more for, or would have been, I know a number even went for local elections and that. It's still, the age profile of the parliament is still pretty
And I think that's because of all of the political groupings across the spectrum. None of them really reflect, I think, the broad views that are there amongst Irish young people. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's I don't think it's the young people's fault. It's the fault of our party politics as it has prevailed, or our Dáil politics, which can be deeply alienating. I mean, people feel, and I'm conscious that I haven't been home for a while, but I do know, talking from my family, like, they would say, even the handling of COVID, people would say, it's just a game to them. We know that the opposition are getting up criticising the government, but sure, if they didn't do this, if they did something else, they'd be criticising just for the sake of it. And people get very demoralised. They don't feel like that it's a real,
what do you think,
I suppose, arena.
It was a bonanza budget on Tuesday. You know, billions. I mean, what do you think you'd have been saying in response to that? I mean, for health alone, 4 billion.
Look, I suppose the question is really, who's going to pay for that at the end of the day? Like, you know what I mean? And I was very conscious of Leo Varadkar's remarks about, oh, don't touch the multinationals and the corporation tax and all of that. And I'd be very fearful that the bill is going to be put on the shoulders of ordinary people. I didn't actually follow the details of the budget, so I don't fully know. But I would be worried about them just pumping money into the HSE as it stands, you know, because actually numerically quite a lot of money has gone in. But in terms of value for the money and investment on frontline staff, it's not there. And unless they correct that and deal with the wages and the conditions of the medical staff on the front line, then pouring money at it is just going to be an absolute failure. It's frightening, actually. They need serious structural reform on our health level.
One of the connected issues that we were just talking about there in terms of the money spent, but it's, you were talking about young people. I mean, it's going to be a massive issue here, that it's mainly jobs where young people are involved, and youth unemployment. Is that something that you're kind of seeing in Brussels and throughout, that it's a fixture of the pandemic? Because it's that sort of jobs, are those sort of jobs that where young people are employed, where they're becoming unemployed as a result of COVID?
Definitely. And I mean, there's a lot of talk about, you know, youth guarantees and opportunities for young people, but it's an absolute feature now. Like, even where I am now, Bulgaria have lost 2 million people have left Bulgaria since they joined the European Union in search of, I suppose, a better life in other parts of Europe or elsewhere, you know. And obviously a lot of them are young people, you know. It's a feature all over, and it's actually really scary. I mean, my heart goes out to any Irish person doing, or their parents doing their leaving cert or starting college now in these days. It's incredible. Not just the lack of job opportunities, but that whole educational sector and how we're dealing with it. It's just the idea of young people now being in schools, going through their teenage years, their personal development, and not being able to mix freely and express themselves in the way in which we could when we were in school is going to cause huge damage going forward, and really needs a lot of careful attention.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, Claire, and I didn't when we were talking about the Dáil, was the incredible work you did on whistleblowers and the on Garda the Síochána, and that was that very pressurizing at the time. I mean, it really was. I mean, it's easy to look at it now on Maurice McCabe and all of that after it's over, but how intense was it at the time?
Oh yeah, no, at the time now, it used to be like when we used to raise it at first. Well, for starters, like, we genuinely believe that they contrived to not have the issues raised, so to try and deny us speaking time on issues, and we had to break the rules to even introduce the topics and kind of speak on it out of turn, like before they shut you up. That was one side. But yeah, and I mean, we got slated for it in the early years. People have gone, how dare you? Those men and women were on the front line, you know, defending us with their lives, as if like we were kind of, you know, out arguing for, you know, crazy stuff. So yeah, it wasn't nice, because at that time...
But what about the public? What about members of the public and their reaction?
I know they were okay about it, I think, pretty much, you know, because I think, you know, in fairness, Maurice had done his homework and it was around, and the points we were making touched a curve, because it was our nerve. It was about that idea of privileged people getting away with things because of their connection, and ordinary people being shafted. And ordinary people would have seen, which we see a little bit now, but less, the guy in the car pulling up on the double yellow lines and going into McDonald's for the, you know, the chips and whatever, and then coming out and probably giving a young fella a ticket for doing the same thing. That type of thing now. And nobody would dream of saying anything to the guard before, but now they would. They'd say, what do you think you're doing, kind of there. So attitudes have changed, which is great, because that's the way it should be. And look, early on, there were problems from guards early on, for sure. There was.
Question here, it's directly sort of, it's Maureen McGovern saying, do you think you were harassed by the state? And was that one of your decisions, one of your reasons to decide to move to stand for the European Parliament? I suppose it's a roundabout version of when you started raising these issues, whether you felt that in an organised way, you know, that you were moved against in any sort of a way to put pressure.
Not to the point that it bothered me. I mean, obviously the time that I was arrested for alleged drink driving, it was a bit shocking at the time, like, you know, and I mean, I was handcuffed on the side of the road, which is completely against procedures. Now, I've never even done a breath test before. I didn't even know how to do it, like, you know. So that, and then they released the story to the news within 24 hours. Like, I hadn't even told my family or the girls in the office or anything. So it was pretty dreadful at the time. I remember my daughter saying to me, going into school, what happens if, you know, my friends say, oh, you're an alcoholic, like, God almighty. It was dreadful, right? It was dreadful. But we won that, and we won it quite quickly. And I won it by, I remember getting the call. I was getting a few calls during the day, and I'm kind of going, why are the media ringing me? This couldn't possibly be to do with the fact that I was arrested last night. Could it, kind of, when I had told really nobody? And then just before the 6 o'clock news, eventually RTE got me, and I just had to decide there and say, right, I'm going to come out now. I'm not having 3 or 4 days of them smoking me out. Who is the politician who was, you know, I just got to take it head on, which I did. And immediately then people were okay about it because I said, yeah, I was stopped. I was in an area I didn't know. I had had a drink, but look, it's gone for a test. Now I was well under the limit and all that anyway. Yeah. And I did think it was suspicious. And the behaviour of the guards on the day wasn't nice. What they did, what they said wasn't nice, you know. But look, we live to tell the tale, and it actually backfired again.
You're giving me the impression that you're as cool as a cucumber despite the circumstances, which is a marvellous thing to have. Or is it...
That didn't bother me. No, I mean, look, it was terrible, right?
I don't even mean just with that. I mean, generally, it sounds like you have a great sense of sort of your own your equilibrium, you know, and that it would take a lot to take you off course. Or
I haven't always been like that. I'm a lot less stressed now than I was. I used to be very stressed, and I was probably very stressed when I was involved in party politics. Do you know what I mean? And I think political parties can put people under an awful lot of pressure to perform in a certain way and to do things that maybe they're not sure about or whatever. And I think for people getting involved in politics, they should be true to what they believe in themselves and answer their own conscience, what they feel is right. And I think if you do what you feel is right, even if you end up doing the wrong thing, well, you're trying for the right reasons. So, well, what have you got to recriminate yourself with? Okay, I made a mistake. But sure, everybody makes a mistake. If we don't make mistakes, we don't learn. So I think it's this idea that a lot of politicals say, you know, we have to be perfect, or we have to have all the answers, or we can't make a mistake. Well, actually, you can, because people make mistakes every day. And that's how we learn things. So it's a good thing. Yeah. So, no, I'm pretty chill now. I am. But I mean, I wasn't always. And there are people who would tell you I'm not always chill. But, you know, we'll see. I have to address a protest in Bulgaria tomorrow night. We'll see how chill I am then. But I'm sure I'll be grand, you know.
Yeah, well, I just keep thinking, no wonder you're chill. You're in a T-shirt on your way to the beach in Bulgaria. And let me tell you, that looks an awful lot better.
And so the weather's, I'm actually sweating sitting here now. I'm kind of absolutely wiping the sweat off. It's roasting, but...
Listen, we're coming close to the end, and you really are great to even have pulled in and to be doing that. You still have a good bit of time left in the Parliament. You said earlier you're not sure. You could well end up standing for the Dáil again. I think you're safe enough for a while. I don't see us having a general election for a little bit, given the virus. So what are the plans for the sort of medium term future, and where you want to be?
I don't know, right? I mean, we're still getting used to the European Parliament, right? I'm beginning to, so it's a year and a little bit in, beginning to find my feet on the various committees that I'm on. So I'm on the Transport Committee, where I do a lot of work around aviation issues, which obviously was my background. I'm also on the Civil Liberties Committee. So that's where we've done a huge amount of work, where a lot of the Bulgarian stuff would come up. And now I'm on Security and Defence. So Ireland's neutrality and military expenditure is something that we're kind of really taking a turn to. I suppose the stuff with Bulgaria over the last while has given me a completely different glimpse into how Europe is viewed in Europe, not in Ireland, but in Europe. And I mean, when I was a county councillor and I got elected to the Dáil, people said to me, oh, you know, will you fix my pothole or whatever? And I'd say, well, no, I mean, I'm not a councillor anymore. I'm in the National Parliament. My job is a legislator. And if you don't like that, well, don't vote for me. When we got elected to the European Parliament, we got elected to represent the citizens of Europe. So my job is equally to advocate on issues in Bulgaria or Lithuania or wherever, or Ireland for that matter. So it's been incredible to be a voice for people in a country that you've never been. Well, I was in my holidays about, you know, 35 years ago when it was in to go to Bulgaria, you know. I can't remember it. But other than that, I've no connection with Bulgaria, even though the newspapers have done articles saying that I'm a property mogul in Bulgaria, like, but I actually don't have any property here at all. I had to tell them the only property I have is half owned by the EBS and it's in Swords. But so that's given me a glance of, you can use the Parliament as well to be a beacon for change anywhere. And I've met people, I've a list of people who are meeting me here who are trying to organise civil society groups. We're meeting LGBTI groups tomorrow who've been persecuted, environmental campaigners and so on, and just giving them the confidence to challenge things for themselves.
But how about if I was to say to you, well, Claire Daly, you're an Irish MEP. What good is it to me, an Irish citizen, that you're around Bulgaria and you're helping them with their corruption?
I suppose because if it's corrupt in Bulgaria, it's corrupt in Ireland as well. If the funds are being used to further corruption in any part of the European Union, well, then we're all culpable in that system, you know. And it's bringing down, I suppose, the fabric of the European Union. We're sold this idea that it's a project for solidarity across borders, for rule of law, for fairness and democracy. Whereas in actual fact, what I'm seeing a lot of the time is it's a union organised the interests of big business, big agri, the arms industry, the industrial lobbyists and so on. And it's the citizens, be they in Ireland or Bulgaria or wherever, that are losing out from that process. So by, I suppose, democratizing it, you're cutting across that. But I mean, equally, we're not taking up Irish issues. It's just that's where we happen to be at the moment.
I can't find the question, but somebody did ask earlier whether it was responsible of you to be traveling like this during the pandemic.
Well, we're following, obviously, all health guidelines as part of that. And I mean, Bulgaria is a really low rate of COVID at the moment. It's actually green. We have a traffic light system across the European Union. There's regular testing and all of that, which we avail of, and social isolating and wearing masks. So everything we've done has been within the guidelines. And actually, MEPs travel all the time. They're exempt from some scrutiny, which I wouldn't agree with, and we do all the testing where it should be tested and all of that. But no, I mean, I get it. It's different in Ireland, but people in Europe view it differently. Borders don't have the same meaning here because, you know, you could be nearer to another country than your own country, given the scale of some of these countries.
Last question, Claire, and it's from Sue Gogan, and she's saying, and you touched on this earlier about how you're more chill now as a result of not being at a party. And Sue is wondering, does Claire think we should get rid of the party political system? Would it make for less stressed politicians, Claire?
I think it would. Yeah, totally. I mean, how we get on, I mean, it's kind of party, like you can't really...
How would you ever pass the law?
I know. Well, look at, I mean, yeah, but two people need to be whipped into it. Do you know what I mean? Could you get, I mean, look at the Citizens' Assembly. We brought citizens, 100 randomers into a room. They listened to the experts and they made decisions and majority, and they learned by exchanging views rationally. So look at, I know it's not possible in the short term or maybe not ever that we get rid of parties. But yeah, I mean, to me, it felt that people spend so long serving the party to get the nomination or to get the canvassers to go out for them, that they forget why they're doing it in the first place, you know. And I remember when I left a party, it was a big choice. You say, oh my God, I'm leaving now. The party has the contact lists, it has the leafleters, it organized the money to go out. If I go on my own, am I going to be able to do that? But you have to say, well, look, it's worth a try, like, do you know what I mean? And people have to have confidence that just go for it, like, you know, because if you're not comfortable doing what you're doing, you're not going to be any good at it anyway. So I suppose you have to trust yourself first and foremost. And I think there can be, and I've seen it in people in all political parties, they're conflicted in what they believe and what the party tells them to do. Sometimes, not always. And that's unfortunate, you know, but you look at, we'll see. We won't get rid of parties overnight, that's for sure.
Well, look, Claire, I think that's a great note to end on. And thank you so much to Claire Daly, somewhere in Bulgaria. You might take a spare 5 minutes and build a sandcastle later and think so. And good luck. Thanks a million for your
time. Thanks very much, Alison. Lovely to talk to you again. And to the other Alison.
And thank you both. I just wanted to finish off by saying that's a definite first win for election to broadcast from a lay-by in Bulgaria. But look, this is where we are. And it gives us a bit of flexibility in terms of bringing in speakers from all over the world, which is fantastic. Thank you so much, Claire. I think you gave us a real roller coaster ride there through politics, through all your experiences, and I think inspiration to what's possible in terms of just going for it. Really like what you said about finding something that you want to change, and if that's your inspiration, just go for it. So hopefully that's some words of wisdom to some of the many young women listening today who I know are thinking about making that leap. So thanks, Claire. And thank you, Alison, again, for asking all the questions we wanted to ask ourselves. So thank you both. And to everybody listening, please join our next event. We'll keep you posted on our training as it comes up. Visit the website, see what we're about. Loads of courses coming up, loads of interesting stuff, hopefully that can support you on your political journey. And if you could press that donate button on the website, give us a few bob to keep the wheels turning, we'd be delighted. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you for joining us for our fascinating conversation with Claire Daly MEP and Alison O'Connor. You can subscribe to the podcast where you'll find many more thought-provoking conversations with some of the most prominent women in Irish politics. Like what we do, why not join us in our movement to get more women in Irish politics? Check out our website, womenforelection.ie.